Yes.
All right. Good afternoon. If I could have your attention, please, we'll get started with this session. My name is Jim Lenker. I'm from the Rehabilitation Science Department at the University at Buffalo. I'm moderating both of the sessions this afternoon in emerging technologies, the one just prior to this and then part two, which we're about to begin now. I'm doing this as a representative of ResNA, as the chair of the research committee. We're quite happy this year to have the support to do this emerging technology session with the help and gracious support of the National Science Foundation, and in particular Bob Yeager, who some of you may know from his previous history with NIDR. As I'm going to have Bob come up in a few seconds and say a few words about his and give sort of a greeting from NSF. And anyhow, Bob transferred from NIDR to NSF last fall, and not long after that, a few months after that, wasted no time and approached ResNA with the idea of putting on an emerging technology session here at the conference. And so, Bob, would you care at this point to come up and just say a few words about NSF's interest in supporting this work at ResNA?
Okay, well, thanks, Jim, and I want to thank Jim and all the folks at ResNA that worked so hard to pull these two sessions together. And as they say on Emerald Live about halfway through the show, if you're just joining us, shame on you, you know. All right. Since coming to NSF, I've really seen the possibilities there, and want to talk about kind of what I view as the old model of disability research, where you had billions of dollars going into NASA and DARPA, and they develop all these wonderful things and materials and technologies and algorithms. Then it kind of filters down, and then there's the rehab engineers that say, "Oh, I think I can take this and apply this to individuals with disabilities." So the rehab engineers are kind of the bottom feeders, and the big money, you know, top of the food chain is fighting over the big bucks, and then stuff filters down. I'd like to challenge everyone to say, how about if we reverse that and say there are really challenging problems related to individuals with disabilities, and if we came up with some real innovations and real cutting edge of discoveries along this line, those things might be useful to folks at NASA and DARPA and things like that. So, you know, let's see some real creativity here, and that was sort of part of the reason for talking to ResNA about trying to start sessions like this. And I'd certainly be happy to have any feedback anyone has on these sessions and any ideas anyone has for the future. And just again, thanks to ResNA for putting this together. Thanks, Jim.
And thank you again, Bob. It's now my pleasure to introduce Susan Sprake. Susan has been working as an attorney for 26 years in the area of working with businesses to advance adoption of new technologies. And I'll avoid the tendency to have the cheap attorney jokes, since my sister is also an attorney, and so we have nothing but respect in our household for the fine work that attorneys do. And now Susan has been involved throughout her career in the technology transfer process and in the legal aspects associated with that with respect to intellectual property rights. And in her travels, she has worked not only in private practice in San Francisco for 6 years on intellectual property protection and awareness, but she's also worked at NASA, two Department of Energy labs, and for the past 10 years has been at Los Alamos National Lab. And her expertise, again, is as a negotiator of tech transfer and intellectual property rights. In addition to that, she's the current vice chair of the Federal Labs Consortium. And so as the substantial portion of her talk is going to be today will be about providing an overview of the Federal Labs Consortium and some of the technologies coming out of those labs. And with that, I'll turn the podium over to Susan. Thank you very much for coming.
Well, good afternoon. I would walk around and do my little presentation back and forth across the podium area here on the little rise that we have, but I've been told that I will get a sunburn if I stand in front of the projector. So you're stuck with an animated person at a microphone, so I hope that that'll be sufficient. I'm going to talk a little bit today about the Federal Laboratory Consortium, and one of the things that I would like to impart to you is it's okay to be a bottom feeder. If some of the technology that I have an opportunity to present a little bit about today inspires someone to take it forward and turn it into a product, then I've done my job. There's so much technology out there. Some of our conversations have been, it's really hard to find it all. There's just so much. And so I'm going to address that a little bit, but a lot of work can certainly be done in that area. So if you'll bear with me, I'm going to tell you a little bit about the FLC, the Federal Laboratory Consortium. And my hope is that you will use this presentation as a tool to locate a laboratory that may have a technology that you're interested in. So let me tell you a little bit about it. We cover about 700 laboratories across the nation. Now, to imagine, you know, some of these are two people agri labs, some of them are 8,000 to 11,000 people labs, such as Los Alamos National Laboratory. So you get all sizes. And we, in our membership, we have about 253 active laboratories. And they cover everything from NASA, Department of Defense, agriculture, transportation, just about anything you can think of, NIST, NIH, just a whole gambit of them. And it's important to know that we were officially formed by statute with the directive to make sure that we worked with professionals within the laboratory to transfer technology out of the laboratory to the private sector. Along with that, we're supposed to work with state and local governments if we can, and to some degree to universities. Many of the laboratories have incredible relationships with the regions right around them, as well as internationally. And I'm very lucky that I'm from Los Alamos National Laboratory, and I promise I won't take names or numbers or anything, but we have relationships with people all across the globe, and some of them are very exciting, and I get to go to some exciting places and meet some fantastic people. Just a bit about the structure. Part of this is to help the folks that are in the RESNA governing body to see how we may match up at some point with things that you guys are doing. And so we have elected positions in chair, vice chair. We have six regional coordinators, all of which are elected from the region. And then our laboratory representatives are people like you and I who have the right to vote on certain initiatives throughout the FLC's charter. We have national advisors that are appointed, not elected. They're appointed. They advise our organization very well with up-and-coming industry needs and help us with our structure, just a variety of things. And by hire, we have a Washington, D.C. representative that sits on the Hill and keeps us informed of certain legislative initiatives. And I often spend a little bit of time writing legislation or adding to it or reviewing it, whatever might be needed in that way. This is how we've divided up the country. So in each one of these sections, you'll have a regional coordinator and a deputy regional coordinator whose responsibility is to know what the labs are all about that within the region, where they are, you know, who you can contact, and some basic information. So as I tell you a little bit about some of the technologies, if you think there's a technology within a certain region that you want to get to know more about, this is step one, is contacting your regional coordinator. There are other more in-depth ways of getting a hold of laboratories, but this is certainly a good step. And, you know, I kind of like this slide. You know, I don't know why. This frog just always captured my attention. So, we are in the business of promoting technology out of these federal laboratories. They're entrusted with public taxpayer dollars. They are told to do a certain mission. You will protect this country, or you will come up with new agri designs. You're told to develop a space station, and new generations of space travel, whatever the mission might be, and Congress tells us what we have to spend the money on. It's my job to be a bottom feeder and to find those technologies that can be used for other activities and to help inspire those that want to be innovators to take those technologies and turn them into products. And we do a lot of different things at the FLC. We have education and training for folks that want to be tech transfer specialists, and we invite industry to come so they can learn how to negotiate and deal with the laboratories. So it's, both sides of the coin. We try to address that. We have a lot of publications, and I'll go into some of those. We have conferences, regional as well as national. We have a very large awards program, and we try to award or recognize folks that are in partnerships with the laboratory that have come out with new and novel technologies. A bit about the committees real quick. We have Education and Training Committee, which I've just mentioned a little bit about, and we have all levels from basic to advanced. Communications and Publications, awards, these are internationally as well as nationally recognized awards. State and Local Government is our newest committee to actually get some meat behind it, and we want to work with a number of state economic development groups and make sure that they're taking advantage of technologies that are within these laboratories. So this is one that we're currently populating with volunteers. Policy and Planning, as Vice Chair, I'm in charge of Policy and Planning, and a program committee that does our annual events. Again, training the professional is probably at the top of the list of things that we want to make sure happen. We provide the tools and the services and the books so that you can set up a technology transfer office in any government facility. And we like that, any government facility. The Green Book is, we call that, I don't know why it ended up getting this name. I think one time we put a green cover on it and it stuck with it. So it has, no relevance to what's inside of it. But inside of it are all the laws that regulate transferring technology out of federal laboratories, licensing, intellectual property protection, how, when, why you can do it. And so it's become an invaluable tool for people that want to work with laboratories to know what the rules are and for those that are in the offices to understand what their bases are. The desk reference is a similar thing. It's how, inside this book, you'll learn how to set up an office, a tech transfer office within a laboratory. You'll learn how to do different agreements and, basically get your first introduction to intellectual property and how to protect different types of intellectual property. We have intermediate classes, and these are, I always like to call these exchange of best practices. So we spend a lot of time talking to each other. Some of the mechanisms that we use to transfer technology out to industry, out to universities, out to a spin-out individual that's leaving the laboratory and wants to develop a new product, we have a whole slew of mechanisms that we can work with. Probably the most popular one is our Cooperative Research and Development Agreements, and those are called CRADAs. And this is where we do some work, you do some work, together we create a new product. Together we test a new concept, and at the end of the day, we either share in the intellectual property or we license a piece of intellectual property out to the company. A number of variations on the theme. But this is, for the first time by legislation, we were given the right to have an industrial-type agreement with companies. Before, it was if government money touches it, government owns it. Poop out of luck, sorry. The CRADA allows you to have a more shared environment. If you invent it, you own it. If we invent it, we own it. If we invent it and we own it, we have to give you a first option for intellectual property, first option for a license, or for a license for a patent or for software. So it sort of turned the tables around a little bit and made working with the government for this type of activity far more palatable. The advanced classes get into some of the things that I like to teach, negotiation skills, different ways of writing a license, different ways of putting partnerships together that may be a little new. And so we have a lot of fun with these classes, and they switch up every year. So we have a variety of folks that like to teach the advanced classes. Now, what I want to talk to you guys about a little bit today is some of our partnerships. Now, I come from a laboratory that has a history from, you know, World War II. I don't know. Has anybody ever heard of Los Alamos National Laboratory? I mean, a few of you, okay. You know, we're known for making the bomb, you know, but, you know, we haven't done that in a long time. But since, because we were so secretive for many, many years of its history, they had to develop its own engineering program, you know, its own computational programs, its own materials program, chemistry, physics. And we weren't able to rely on anyone else to provide us with the tools we needed because we didn't really exist. So consequently, over time, the depth of knowledge at this one laboratory in these fields is unbelievable. And it's my pleasure, as I was saying earlier, that I get to meet different folks in different fields and learn about their science, and it's always something different and new and exciting. And so we try to translate some of that out to some of our partnerships. On this slide you see Chevron, 3M, Procter & Gamble, and one of the fun things, you know, that I always like to show is what in the world would a baby diaper manufacturer have in common with a federal nuclear weapons laboratory, you know? I mean, I know that it's been in the news lately about, you know, this great diaper that this woman wore for 500 miles. We didn't make it, okay? It didn't come from us, you know. But it is kind of intriguing, you know. But anyway, we helped them figure out how to optimize their particular issue in manufacturing. They had all the data points that they had collected on how their facilities worked, but they didn't know how to optimize it. And then we put all the data points into our statistical models, played with it a bunch, and asked them some questions. And the next thing we knew, we had a piece of intellectual property called Power Factory. And over a course of about 5 years, it helped save one company over $1 billion in operating costs and how they laid things out. So we've got the grand scale projects with industries such as Procter & Gamble, the grand scale projects with Chevron. We just helped them find all that oil that you've been hearing about that was just discovered in the Gulf. That came from our downhole sensor that can go quite deep and is not affected by cold because it changes pressure and temperature going down so far. And we helped them locate, you know, a tremendous oil reserve there in the Gulf. And we continue to work these relationships with large companies. We also have incredibly wonderful relationships with small businesses and spin-out companies. And those are kind of more fun for me because I get to see the passion that's within a company that they want to create something and do something new. And I'm going to tell you just a little bit about some of the technologies that are coming down the pike. Now, one of the things that I can't do is wave a magic wand and satisfy everybody's desires to have a certain technology here right now helping. But what I hope is that you hear a little bit about some of these technologies that are coming down the pike now, and your innovation and your thoughts can maybe turn it into a product, or you can mention it to somebody else and it turn it into a product that they can use. So what are some of the things I'm going to just mention very briefly? We've got conducting polymers, which are awesome. You know, the world of nano. Everybody heard of nano? I mean, my goodness, you know, we've got so much going on in the nano field. Second sight, communications, batteries, and sensors. So I'm just going to touch a little bit on each one of those as my time allows, and somebody give me the cutoff sign when I'm going too long. I can talk forever. It's a lawyer thing, you know. Sorry. Anyway, conducting polymers, some of the things that we're looking at is materials that will create muscle artificially through polymers that conduct electricity, and also with some other sensors and things combined with it. We have a really awesome piece of technology right now that is organic and inorganic that actually attaches to the tissue on the inside and helps build and transfer tissue along, so it actually helps to build your own tissue in different ways. And it's artificially stimulated. Now, we're doing this for a completely different reason. It has nothing to do, you know, with any sort of assistive technology or anything. But it could be applied to that in the future. So as that matures, guys keep an eye on it because it may be something that somebody can use. And we have some this material is also very, very lightweight. But very durable. So some of these conductive polymers show real promise of working with limbs. The world of nano, we also have, nano, we can't even see it, it's so small. And we have some combinations between organic and inorganic nanofibers that build on themselves. So you've got the organic that moves along, the inorganic that attaches and brings with it certain properties and can continue to attach nerves, rebuild a number of things. They're looking at it for bone replacement, and I think it's probably going to be better in the nerve area. We use it for weapons. You take what they do, you turn it around, you make it better. What is that, swords to plowshares, is an old favorite saying of mine. And I loved it when I heard it the first time, and I still like to hear it, because some of the stuff that comes out of this mission-related work that Congress says you have to do turns out to be fantastic stuff. Second sight is also... Whoops, that went too fast. There we go. Second Sight is a project that's coming out of Oak Ridge National Laboratory, and the goal is to embed a microelectronic device that consists of multiple artificial retina chipset and implant it into the eye and allow patients to see images. Now, this came out of robotics research. There's a lot of places where you just don't want a person going into a certain environment. And so you have to have robotic guys that can really see. And they need to see and know what they're seeing. Now, one of the issues that has come out of this is a group out of Oak Ridge. They said, well, can it apply, to sight? I don't know. They thought, well, let's give it a try. And there's a lot of debate on this as to whether or not you want to give somebody false hope, this may not come about for 10 to 15 years, and I say hope is hope, If somebody wants that and it's available and it can happen, let's go for it. Some of the issues with this that we've seen so far is there are so many microprocessing modules to this. It's so complex, but it's awesome. Another part of it that I've noticed also from the reports I'm getting is it's in black and white or various shades. There's a debate, and this is not my field, there's a debate of whether it's good to see in color if you haven't seen before, or if black and white grayscale is better. I'm sure that's an interesting topic to folks. I have no knowledge on that whatsoever, but they're paying attention to this in this experiment to see if this will work and what ways it'll work better. Infocom is a two-way reflective radio technology. And I wanted to bring this up. We've heard a little bit about batteries today. We've heard about communication devices. If you're in a 5-foot radius or a 10-foot radius, you have a possibility of receiving information. The Infocom travels from 1 mile to 3 miles. It has a antenna that if you imagine like you're in a hospital and you have a hospital band, it would be on that size of an antenna. And as long as you have the system at the top of a tower, something raised up above, most of the buildings, you can locate someone 1 to 3 miles out, depending. And the bracelet has no energy. It only responds when it's pinged. And when it's pinged, then all the things that it's been collecting information on passively will charge, respond, and come back to the receiver. Now, this technology was developed for our warfighter. There's a lot of situations where we have a soldier out there. We don't want anybody to know where he is, period. We don't want him emanating any power source outside of his own body heat. And even with the body heat, and I'll talk about that later, we don't even want that if we can avoid it. But every once in a while, we've got to contact him, find out where he is, etc. And so they came up with this pretty wonderful piece of technology. And it's starting to work its way out now into industry. The first thing that we've seen is called underground radio. And it can go 1,000 feet under the ground through rock to locate a miner. So that's pretty good. You know, so with some other adaptations, it may have some future applications that are more specific. Favorite topic, hydrogen fuel cells. You know, if all the fuel cell technology would finally get its act together and work well, of course, then our carbon footprint for mobility would probably no longer be an issue. But we created years ago, I mean, this has got to be, as long as I have been at Los Alamos, as we've been 10 years, they have had, you know, the hydrogen fuel cell mobility device, and it runs on a fuel cell. And all its only byproduct is water. A little water vapor. And we've taken it to a number of different places. We've taken it to Disney, you know, to see if we could entice them to get rid of their lead acid batteries in their floats and use the fuel cell battery instead. Now, the beauty of the fuel cell technology is that it started to be created in the 70s when we had the first oil crisis. They perfected it. The problem that we have is with the little solenoid, you know, it just deteriorates so quickly. And so they're working on new materials. And also it has to be platinum. You know, has anybody tried to buy platinum recently? So we're trying to find new materials that are cost effective and will be just as good. And I think we're there. From my laboratory, I think we're there. And so we'll be seeing some more technology coming out for this. It's very lightweight, very easy to manage. You know, so hopefully the hydrogen economy will be here in my lifetime. Not much of that left. No, sorry. You know, sensors. We have a number of sensor technology, remote sensing again. You know, that there's, you know, telemedicine. When I was first introduced to telemedicine, I was at NASA, and it was like the early 80s. And then I went to the DOE laboratories later, and everybody was talking about telemedicine. We've got to be able to help the Navy be able to respond to a need when they're out in the middle of the ocean if they've got a medical problem that's, you know, that they need to talk to somebody way back in Hawaii, you know, using satellite, blah de blah de blah. And so they began to really develop a fabulous telemedicine program. And I think they've perfected it now for most people that have in-home care, you know, and have that sort of issue. So you can dial up, you know, if your file's on file somewhere. They can also do some remote scanning. They can have the biosensors that can tell you if you've got, it's called a DNA dipstick. I don't know if it's on, yeah, it's on this slide. The DNA dipstick can tell you whether you have the flu or the cold, okay? You know, so that's the difference between whether you have to get in some vehicle and go in and get some medication or call someone to come out to see you, or, you know, just bear with it, it'll be over in a couple of days, that sort of thing. This DNA dipstick can also be used. They're working, I was just over in Africa in November, and we're trying to deploy it for areas with malaria and some other infectious type diseases so that they can tell what it is immediately and not have to, you know, do a whole scan of antibiotics. So it's really quite fun to see those things. These sensors were made in case we had a biological warfare event. So we've got a whole slew of things that it can detect, and oh, by the way, it can also detect, you know, signature bacteria and viruses. Now, my job is intellectual property. I always tell people that come from various sizes of businesses, I am a nice attorney, okay? You know, you know, I and you know, and I sometimes I'm blonde and sometimes I'm not. So 5 minutes. And so if anybody ever has a question about how to deal with intellectual property while working with a federal laboratory, give me a call. It's free. You won't have very many attorneys tell you that. And I'm going to go through these kind of quickly. We have a lot of publications and communication devices that tell you about technologies coming out of the federal laboratories. Check them out. They're online. Here's a picture of some from last year, the awards booklet as well as the technology transfer success stories. We have 2007 success stories that's just come out. We also have a locator service. If you have a small business and you have a problem, a technical problem, and you want to see if a laboratory can help you, write it up, send it through the locator service. They'll see if they can find someone that will be able to answer your question. It's really kind of fun for us to do that. And in summary, we use all of the devices that we can that are modern and available to get the word out about technology available from the laboratories, and then you get back to us issues that you'd like us to find for you or work on, and we're happy to do that. And thank you very much. No questions. Yes, sir.
Just talk.
Just talk?
Mesa Bhopal from North Carolina State University. My question is, do you usually work with researchers directly, or is your students talk to the technology transfer offices of the university that you are involved in?
Okay. I think the question was, do I work with the scientists direct,
or the technology transfer office?
I'm from the technology transfer office, and so I communicate certainly with the scientists at my laboratory and other laboratories. Is that what you're asking?
Federal agency that you are working at, or you also connect to other scientists?
Great. Good question. As with my Los Alamos National Laboratory hat on, I work with Los Alamos National Laboratory scientists and technologists to promote their technology. However, as vice chair of the FLC, we have a whole slew of laboratories, and we try to get their technologies out and aware, you know, on our website and our publications up to the Hill in Washington on what they're doing. So we work both sides of the street trying to get that technology awareness out. Does that answer that? Mm-hmm.
Hi, I'm from New Brunswick, Canada. I'm just curious, is there anything equivalent in Canada at all that...
You know, I want to say yes, but I think it's a little bit different. Now, the FLC has been working with some of the ministries in Canada, and we've had them come to our annual meetings. We've been to, you know, to their annual meetings as they promote technology out of their region. Just like in Europe, you've got Proton Europe, which tries to work in the EU, you know, to do knowledge. They call it knowledge transfer, you know, and SARNA in South Africa. There's a variety of regional groups around the world that also try to promote technologies that are coming out of those laboratories or institutions. Usually it's, you know, research institutions in that arena. Mm-hmm.
I'd like to ask a question. You mentioned in one of your slides, Susan, that there are industry representatives to your advisory panel.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if it would be, thinking strategically from RESNA's perspective, would it be possible for RESNA or a constituent of RESNA to be on this, to infiltrate this advisory panel and maybe bring some of our disability perspectives and needs to bear on your advisory council?
I think that would be awesome. Advisory panel is run by a gentleman by the name of Rick Trotta, and he's always looking for people with passion and that are willing to pull other people together, you know, to bring an awareness or get the word out about available technologies. So I think approaching him and talking to him about that would be, you know, right on. We also have MOUs with a number of different organizations like SBIE, LES, Autumn, you know, just to mention a few. IRI, I don't know if you know that one, but that's an industrial research institute out of North Carolina. So we have MOUs where we exchange space on their web pages. We exchange time at conferences to give presentations. So we're always trying to expand the knowledge of the technologists in these laboratories. So I don't see why not. Let's check it out.
Well, we're nothing if not a passionate group, so I think
yeah.
We might be able, that might be a good fit for us. I actually have another question, and since I've got the mic, I'll go ahead and ask it. You spoke a lot about partnerships with industries,
mm-hmm.
And we have a couple of representatives here from federal agencies, namely the National Institutes of Health with Nancy Shinawara, and Bob here from the NSF. Do the federal labs collaborate at all with some of the other federal agencies that are responsible for research in very specific areas? Any interfaces in particular between NSF and the NIH?
Yeah, that's kind of a two-pronged question in a sense that by statute, the quote-unquote technology transfer offices, or the acronym is ORTAs, were established to transfer technology out of their particular institute out, you know, to industry, small businesses, municipalities, et cetera. So from that perspective, they go out into industry. However, there's another whole aspect to it where we receive money from NASA, for instance, to work on things with the space station, you know, and with different satellite technology. NIH has worked with NASA, you know, with different issues, you know, and we're always trying to find what technology we have, because we do a lot of nuclear bio type work. And so some of that is of interest to NIH, and so we have relationships, university type relationships, funding relationships. And so those all happen in a sort of like day-to-day work at the laboratories, and where my role is more pushing the technology out. So it's kind of two different areas, but there's a lot of overlap.
I just wanted to mention we've got a representative from another federal agency here, Shelley Reeves from NITR. So if you have any NITR-related questions, Shelley's here. But I wanted to ask a question about, for lack of a better term, orphan technology. Oftentimes there are technologies, as many folks in the room know, that are only going to be applicable or useful to a very small percentage of the population. And typically these things don't generate the type of interest that's something that's going to make billions of dollars or something like that. It isn't going to make a lot of money, but it's going to be very, very important for a small group of individuals. Is there anything in the FLC? I know in the past there have been many attempts to, you know, talk about this issue, but it seems like that issue never really has been satisfactorily resolved. Do you want to comment?
Yeah, I absolutely agree that it hasn't satisfactorily been resolved. As a matter of fact, it's one of my pet peeves, but you know, we kind of live in a world where if there's, you know, not money in it, then it's very hard to get people interested in doing it. And we've had some success, kind of through the back door success. But it's very exasperating for folks like me and you that, you know, look, you know, we've got a piece of technology that's dynamite. We have a piece of technology right now that's called FlexLock, which is a flexible type of technology that can have all kinds of power sensors going through it. It's very lightweight. It can be cool. It can be warm. It can stimulate, you know, it can do all kinds of things. But what it was made for was for ballistic resistant technology, you know, for the warfighter. And we are just frustrated trying to get them to develop it just a little bit further to interest a group that may have an application for it, and will take a risk on putting money into it to see if that can happen. All those ifs, you know, are diminishing dollar signs, and it is just agonizing. It's just agonizing. And the FLC promotes these technologies when we can, but I don't have the answer. I wish I did.
Any other questions? I've actually got one last question, okay, if I might. You mentioned the partnerships with the larger companies, the Chevrons and Motorola's, yes, and so forth. And those are much bigger operations, much higher profile, and I'm sure from the Federal Labs perspective, those are good. Those are very good PR for you, and kind of what one of the things that the government's hoping that you might be able to do. By comparison, our field we're like flying a crop duster in comparison to those 747s. Do we have a prayer?
Absolutely.
In terms of penetrating the federal lab structure as a relatively, you know, a much, much smaller player.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm glad you asked that question, because sometimes those particular slides can be a little daunting. In the legislation, and I'm kind of a legal legislative kind of person, preference is given to small businesses, to municipalities, not-for-profit organizations. That's written in the legislation. And currently, I've just set up at my laboratory a small business technical assistance fund. And you have to be a really small business to get into this fund. But we will pay up to $20,000 a year of a researcher's time to work with you, you know, on a project. Right now, it's limited to New Mexico. You know, but I'm working on it, okay? I'm still working on it. But, you know, in that case, you know, actually the funding that's needed is covered. We have some other funds that we can use, what we call maturation funds, that we can work with a small business if they're strapped for funding as well. But oftentimes, and I would say the majority of our deals, our partnerships, are with small businesses. And it's just, that's just the way it is. The big businesses usually either want to do it on their own or whatever, you know. But so it's a little bit of a misconception to think that it's only the big businesses. Our laboratory structure is a little nervous about big businesses because those are in the paper. And we just don't want anything to go wrong, you know. And so, you know, that isn't always the best solution. So small businesses, absolutely. Yes, ma'am. Yes, we have. She asked if we routinely send people to the national SBIR conferences. We have. There's small business innovative research programs are regional around the country as well as national, and we have representatives that go in each region throughout the year. I go often to places like Colorado or St. Louis and give presentations, or even in New Mexico, depending on where they're having it in that region. And then our national representatives also go to the national. SBIR is a vibrant and wonderful way to get a concept, a feasibility study going, and a concept going, and getting some funding and taking it forward. It's just a wonderful way to go forward on that. You should learn, you know, whoever doesn't know about SBIRs, get some information, because that's excellent. Thank you.
And thank you again, Susan. And we really appreciate you making the effort to come and speak to us. And as a small token of Resna's gratitude, we have this gift for you. So
thank you very much. Yeah. That is very nice. Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks again. At this point, it's my pleasure to introduce Steve Bauer. Steve, as many of you know, is the director of the Technology Transfer RERC, and we're fortunate to have Steve here today to discuss some of the work that their center has been doing in the area of technology transfer, which certainly includes a fair amount of interaction with the Federal Labs Consortium. And so Steve is going to be able to offer us, I think, kind of an insider's perspective on approaches to the federal labs, among other things. So, Steve, please come up and speak to us.
Thank you. First off, I'm going to surprise Jim by telling him that in talks prior to this talk, I was asked to change the orientation a little bit, but I think you'll still enjoy it. It will include some of what Jim talked about, but it's also going to be an overview, or not an overview, but provide a context for why we are at the point we are today, talking about emerging technologies for people with disabilities. If you went back a number of decades, I suspect that this would be a much smaller conversation. But now we have reason to pay attention, and I think it's important to understand why. So first I want to acknowledge our sponsor, the National Institute on Disability and Rehabilitation Research. And we're supposed to do this, but the fact is that they've been kind enough and generous enough to support us for more than a decade. And sometimes it takes that long to actually accumulate enough knowledge to talk about something with anything approaching expertise. I also wanted to thank Bob Yeager and NSF for sponsoring this program, and also Jim Linker. I think Jim's done a really fine job. It's a lot of hard work. You have to track people down, chase people down, and I think he's done a wonderful job as a moderator today, too. So my compliments can keep on going, but I don't want to embarrass him too much. Now, I said that I'm going to provide a context for emerging technologies, assistive technologies, and I want to start by saying, what is assistive technology? And everybody thinks they know what assistive technology is, but in fact, the definitions are all over the place. And as I'm framing this out, I will give examples of technology and emerging technology. Then I'm going to step back and I'm going to provide a historical framework for why the context of emerging technologies is relevant right now. And finally, I'm going to talk about some of the forces and events that are taking place in both the public and private sectors that are both causing and reflecting the emerging technologies. So everybody is familiar with assistive technologies. They look around, and most of you are probably familiar with the Technology-Related Assistance for Individuals with Disabilities Act and the definition of assistive technology that was given there. That's a legal definition. In practice, that's a very broad definition and requires a lot more structure than that. So the World Health Organization came up with the International Classification of Functioning Disability and Health, the ICF model. And they then took over and developed the ISO standards, the ISO 9999 standards. Unfortunately, that standard that came out of the ICF is far broader than the trade definition. So in order to be able to determine what's happening in terms of technologies coming into the marketplace and emerging, had to take a look at that framework and narrow it down and structure it so that the ICF model was as narrow as conceived by trade, let's say. And I also want to thank Jim Lenker. He provided some valuable insight and input in discussions on this, and you know, the thanks go on. The ICF-based taxonomy, I'm not going to go too much into detail because that's not the point of today's presentation, but the ICF component, you might look down the left-hand side, you see body structure and function, activities, participation, and context, and those are the different types of assistive technology. For body function and structure, those are intrinsic technologies. You might think of things like implants of all sorts. If it's inside the body, it's body function and structure. Activities are extrinsic, but they are technologies that will move about with the individual. So think of things like wheelchairs and glasses. Assistive technology participation would be technologies that a person would encounter as in different roles and contexts. Think, for instance, a screen reader or a screen magnifier. And then finally, contextual AT are technologies that go across contexts and roles and go across disability groups. Think, for instance, an authoring tool for accessible websites. And now we get into the picture show. And examples of assistive technology for body and function would include the prosthesis on the left-hand side, which is a hip resurfacing and a disc prosthesis. And then you have cochlear implants and you have cardiac pacemakers. Now, if you'll notice the little blue checks there, we're doing a study that's actually looking at technologies that have come out of the federal laboratory, and a blue check is an indicator that some major research or technology came out of the labs and contributed to the development of these technologies. And I picked the technologies first, and then I went and sort of checked to see whether there was a thread in the federal lab. So I probably missed things as well. But you're going to see that many important technologies actually have a root in the federal laboratory system. Hippocampal implant, rather. This is an example of a cognitive prosthesis, and Kathy Bodine, for people that are familiar with her RERC, is linked to this research. Basically, we have a deep brain structure that's not functioning, and the implant takes the inputs that are going to that malfunctioning brain structure and then does some analysis on those inputs and then produces the proper output, and they've actually implanted these in rats successfully. We have the retinal implants, which Susan referred to. And then we also have neuromuscular skeletal prosthesis, which are the nerve regrowth type technologies. And you ask, why is that an assistive technology? It seems like that might be a medical, a response to a drug or something along that line. But actually, you have nerve stem cells, nerve growth factors, hydrogels, that sort of thing to stimulate the growth. But a lot of times, a lot of the techniques that are actually emerging right now are based on the use of nanotube and polymer scaffolds. So that's actually an implant and would fit the definition of an assistive technology. And then a lot of times what's happening is that these hydrogels and growth factors and so forth are actually part of the scaffolding or attached to the scaffolding and help move the regrowth along. We have AT for activities, and here we have a couple of examples. We have the Sunsoft contact lenses, which is designed with a biocompatible material that came out of Lawrence Berkeley National Labs. And it was developed under a CRADA, and it's in the marketplace. And Sunsoft is one of the major manufacturers of contact lenses in the United States. In the bottom right, we have a Trekker 3 wayfinding system from HumanWare. And this isn't this technology has been around for a few years, but why is it connected to the federal labs? Well, it's obviously using the GPS system technology. So that's an incredibly pervasive technology nowadays, but it's having an incredible impact on our blind people with blindness. And this technology is going to continue to evolve. Now, our mobility technologies, people are familiar with the improvements that are happening in powered mobility and stand-up wheelchairs, seating and positioning, and in the bottom right-hand corner we have the Magic Wheels, which is, I think, is a wonderful manual wheelchair propulsion system. But these technologies are going to continue to evolve, and what you see here is you see the Twill, which is a wheel that was designed for Michelin, and it's actually on this particular iBot variant, and underneath it you have something that looks like a strange sort of nuclear symbol, but the implication here is that the power source for power mobility is going to change and keep on changing radically over the next number of years, and at some point, some of the problems associated, for instance, with lithium-ion technology is certainly going to be overcome. And there's tremendous advantages in lithium-ion battery technology for power wheelchairs, and it will be very helpful. And then that motor on the bottom is actually an adaptive motor technology, and it was also a Tesla technology. The patent is ancient, and when Tesla put the patent in and was granted the patent, he foresaw that there would be control systems capable of controlling the charging and discharging of the windings on this motor, but it didn't exist at that time. You're a little far thinking. And so this motor technology is produced by Wavecrest Laboratories, and it's actually being put into different types of military vehicles. And in the future, because it is so much more efficient and so much less demanding on the power source, you can expect to see it in electric vehicles, and you can expect to see it in wheeled mobility devices for people with disabilities at some time in the future. Now, people are familiar with hearing aids, and the hearing aid that you see at the top is an Acuras hearing aid from Siemens. And the thing about the Acuras hearing aid is that it's actually the first It's the second true binaural hearing aid. Information is exchanged from one hearing aid to the other. And what that does is it dramatically improves the directional performance of the Acuras hearing aid. They have a long way to go. Right now, this is just the tip of the iceberg in terms of improvements of performance. They have built prototypes that should give a 20-fold increase or improvement in directional gain. That would be the directional gain is how loud does it sound in front of you as compared off to the side, basically. And so there's once this technology matures, you're going to end up with binaural hearing aids providing opportunities for people with hearing impairments that they don't have anything like now. Another thing that's happening is you'll see the on the left-hand side, there's an ELI Bluetooth boot for a Starkey hearing aid. And I have the red arrow there that indicates wireless communication with a Motorola cell phone that's Bluetooth enabled. But this kind of technology is going to continue to advance so that a person with hearing impairment will be wirelessly integrated with all kinds of sound sources. And they'll also have the ability to selectively choose which sound source they're getting their sound from. So that's an important breakthrough. On the bottom, for people that are blind, Refreshable tactile displays are an incredibly important technology, and what you see there that in the bottom right is a note taker from GW Micro, and above it is a tactile display from KGS Corporation. It's a South Korean company. It's very expensive, but for practical purposes, the first commercial large screen tactile display. But what's going to happen in the future is you're going to have new technologies that are going to dramatically bring down the price and dramatically improve the performance of tactile displays. And this is one example. I'm aware of another company that's working in this area that's very close as well. But this is a MEMS-based tactile braille display from iActive Corporation, which is a subsidiary of Orbital Research. Orbital Research has a lot of connections with the Department of Defense and the military and the labs. I don't have a check mark there. I could have put one. AT for participation. Now, in this case, there's so many things going on that I've put placeholders. And in the upper left, we have a person wearing a strange hat, and that strange hat happens to be a biosignal or brain signal interface. And there is actually a company, and I have to apologize, but there is actually a company there's two companies in the marketplace right now that are selling biosignal interfaces. Very small numbers of sales, but the fact is that these companies are actually staying in business selling these products. So they have to work at least marginally well, and I think the future is very bright for these technologies. There's a lot of research going on in these areas. And I say it's a placeholder because I think there's a lot of advanced interface technology that will be coming into the marketplace in the next 5 or 10 years. Universal design for learning. Here I show an electronic whiteboard. I could have also put sound field systems in there, and I think there's going to be a lot more technologies that's going to enhance the educational opportunity of our children with disabilities. And finally, on the bottom, I stole a picture from Talking Signs, and I talk about wireless integration. And when we're talking about wireless integration, we're talking about cognitive assistance for the elders. We're talking about environmental controls. We're talking about augmentative communication devices. Think of a person with an augmentative communication device that's wirelessly enabled, and they go into a jewelry store, and the jewelry counter provides information to their augmentative communication device that allows them to provide custom communication back and forth with the person at the counter for what they want to look at, what they want to purchase. And then they turn around and they move their, they go to some other portion of the store, and maybe they're in the clothing section. And so they get the proper information for purchasing or seeing or trying on different clothing. Now that kind of technology is going to be there. You're going into restaurants. It'll be a menu in that case. So that kind of thing is going to happen, and it's going to happen fairly soon. We talked about wayfinding. Think of the GPS system, the Trekker, and now think about the idea that that wayfinding system also is going to pick up local dynamically changing information and integrate it with the information that's downloaded through the GPS system. So sort of a static database merged with a dynamic database. That's going to make those systems far more powerful than they are right now. And then hearing we already talked about. Now, contextual AT, I gave an example of tools for developing accessible websites. One of the tools that I also mentioned there is Compass, which is a tool from Kestra Performance Research. And what that does is it allows clinicians to quantify the performance of different computer interface options so that they can correctly or optimally match up the interface that works best for the individual. And those kind of technologies will come a long way. And finally, I chose the example of the adaptive device locator system from Academic Software, because that's a thing where you can match up a person's functional abilities with the different technologies that are available to meet those functional needs. Now, I'm at the point of my presentation when I want to provide a historical context, and I think this is very important. Now, going back I said that if we were talking about emerging technologies, we wouldn't have much to talk about if we went back too many decades. And I would say that if you go back to the disability and independent living movement, that's sort of the start of where you have to think about the emerging technologies today. And that disability rights movement caused a societal paradigm shift that was embodied finally in legislation, rules, guidelines, and then finally legal challenges. And as a result of the paradigm shift in the legislation, you have new customers, people that weren't buying products or being prescribed products, and you have new markets, the sort of the collection of all those people that were not being served and people didn't care to serve in the past. And then finally, as a result of these market demands, you have new professions. Many of the people in this room probably wouldn't be doing what you're doing today if it wasn't for the disability rights movement 30 or 40 years ago. And you have new industries emerging to serve these needs. And, of course, there's lots of money associated with these markets, which is what makes industry do what it does. And I just want to talk about this is the boring part, but it's actually interesting to some people. We have legislation by type, and I would say there's demand-type legislation, which is the things that's going to increase market size, increase the money in a market, increase requirements on the purchase of technologies, or increase the requirements on the function of technologies. Those are examples. And then there's also supply-side legislation, which is legislation that's going to facilitate product development, applied research, basic research, or capacity building. In the federal laboratories, we're going to talk briefly about a piece of legislation that is on the supply side. And finally, I would say that in terms of legislation, demand-type legislation almost always precedes supply-type legislation in terms of the impact it has. And we'll see that in a second. Examples of demand legislation would be like Section 508 of the Rehab Act, and that has to do with access to electronic and information technology. Everybody is familiar with it. But what you may not be familiar with, and I would say probably not familiar with, is something like the Federal Acquisition Regulations, which came about in 2001 as a result of Section 508. And that required electronic and information technology to be accessible by federal employees and also by people that weren't federal employees that wanted to access federally held information or use federally held systems. And so they required the Department of Defense, the General Services Administration, and the National Aeronautics and Space Administration to purchase technologies that met certain regulations of accessibility. And this was considered as a major ruling, which meant that it had over $100 million of impact on the marketplace per year. And so that's the kind of thing that people don't see, but that's the kind of thing that industry and manufacturers see. So this is 2001, and you can trace this legislation or these regulations in 2001 all the way back to the disability rights movement. If people hadn't been out there advocating, we might not be at this place. And I have a list of demand-side legislation that you're all familiar with. I'm not going to go through it, especially since I think I'm running out of time. Okay. And I want to touch on the demand legislation that I do think is really important, which is the Olmstead Act, which is the Americans with Disability Act, and it's a judicial ruling that followed from it, which is the Olmstead decision. Who's familiar with that anyway? Olmstead decision. Okay. Probably a little less than half in the room. But basically, it said that people with cognitive disabilities, and by extension, any person with a disability, must be able to live in the least restrictive environment. And so that was, as it says, it was originally for persons with cognitive disabilities, but think of disabled elders and elder demographics. So think of people that are in hospitals moving down the chain to nursing home, people in nursing homes moving to some sort of supported living, people in supported living moving to smart homes or some other completely independent environment. And think of all the infrastructure and technologies that are required for that to happen, that shift. And if you think anybody's paying attention, you have to think about companies like Intel and Microsoft, Whirlpool, Black & Decker. Those companies, Intel is working with perhaps a 50-company consortium to develop smart homes, and they're dealing in telehealth and telerehab technologies. And interestingly, when Intel looked at the smart home environment, they came to the conclusion that that it was a system solution that was required that was far more complex than Intel could possibly handle on their own. And, you know, that's pretty impressive when you have one of the world's leading corporations saying that they were not anywhere near up to the task. Microsoft, they work with 137 companies in their Microsoft Accessibility Program to make their operating systems and applications accessible. And why do they bother doing it? Because they're looking forward 20 years for when the people that are in the workforce now using computers and information technology still want to use their computers and information technology, and they want to know how to make those applications accessible, so people are still going to use them, and they can still be feeding that immense elder market to come. I'm going to run out of time. Okay, I'm going to slide through the legislation quickly. I want to mention Stevenson-Widler because that is the dominant legislation for the federal laboratories. Bayh-Dole is an analogous legislation for the universities. And then the SBIR program, which Susan also mentioned, I think is also really important. I wish we had a little more time. But the Commerce and the Stevenson-Widler Act, actually Title 15 of that act, has a focus on disability. And I think it's important to note that. So it was actually put right in the legislation in a recognition that people with disability are important. And I also want to say that we don't have time to actually go through all the technologies that are coming out of the federal labs. It's hard to discover them, actually. But my impression and looking at the federal labs is that there are many, many hundreds and hundreds of technologies, fundamental technologies for people with disabilities that have come out of the federal labs. And for the SBIR system, this is another thing people should be aware of. There's something close to 700 awards that have come out of the 700 plus 300, more than 1,000 awards have come out of the SBIR system, Small Business Innovation Research Program, from five agencies, NIH, Department of Education, NSF, and Agriculture, Transportation. I think I'm repeating myself. Well, anyway, so that's 1,000 awards over a 10-year period, 100 awards per year for the development of technology. That's a very significant and important impetus to the development of assistive technology to serve people with disabilities. Interestingly, our sponsor, the Department of Education, it has an SBIR program that's 1/70th the size of NIH. Don't want to be disparaging to NIH, but the fact is that if you look at this chart, they provide about half the number of awards of NIH for the development of assistive technology funding, devices. And we're going to slide through this. This slide here actually shows that it's an example of the type of technologies. The takeaway from this slide is that it's not just narrow bands of technology, but very broad bands of technology, and by implication, very broad bands of people with disabilities that are being served by this SBIR program. And finally, to wrap up, I wanted to touch on some of the programs so that we could talk for a very, very long time, and I think I can get like Susan, and somebody has to stop me. But the National Institute on Disability and Rehabilitation Research, the RERC program, is an investment by the government of about $20 million a year, roughly, in research and development that benefits people with disabilities. And some of that will and has resulted in new technologies and products. NIH, the National Center on Medical Rehabilitation Research, is another place where the national government is investing in research and development that benefits persons with disabilities. And finally, we have to give Bob some credit. The research to aid persons with disability, which Bob manages, is also a very important program, if a program that people are not well familiar with. And I actually went and put the ICF model on Bob's program over a 10-year period. And if you take a look, there is a lot of applied research going on there toward the development of assistive technologies. There's, as you see, 25, and you can read this as well as I can, but 25 awards for research toward assistive technology for function and structure, almost 10 each for technologies for activities and participation. There's a lot of awards for capacity building, and then there's a lot of awards for basic research, but all in the area of disability and assistive technology. So RAPID is a very important program. And so I think I've gotten to the end. And questions?
Questions?
Going once, going twice. President Hedman.
Thanks. Steve, in the last slide you talked about the federal sources of R&D. Can you describe how important technology transfer is to those various agencies and how the programs try to incorporate that work?
Well, I think it varies. I could go back to the slides, and I think I listed different legislation, and the legislation actually impacts different agencies or different. For instance, Stevenson-Widler affects the federal laboratory system and provides the guidelines and structure for tech transfer, and so that legislation and those agencies are deeply involved in technology transfer, and I think that. What we don't see, and Susan and I talked about this a little bit before, is that there's a tremendous, the federal labs have had a tremendous impact on the needs of people with disabilities and the needs for assistive technology, but it's not something, it's tracked, the work of the labs is tracked in a very distributed manner. And to actually track down the very notable accomplishments of these labs through the years is very difficult. If you look at the legislation for universities, Bayh-Dole, that's the guiding legislation for tech transfer in universities. And there's different levels of success for each of these pieces of legislation and what they do. For the SBIR program, is considered as the flagship of success for probably for the rest of the world. Everybody looks to the U.S. SBIR program as the way to develop small business and new technologies and new products. So I'm not sure if I quite got it, but
one final question. No? Well, thank you, Steve, so much. That was terrific. Really appreciate it. And as with Susan, we have a token of our appreciation that I'll give to you in just a second. If and we want to respect people's time as well, it's gaining on 4:30. Do we have a volunteer in the back with the CEU number? 7722. And so thank you again all for attending this emerging technology session. Lots of good stuff happening later tonight, so hope to see you all at some of those events coming up. And again, if anyone wants to come up and speak directly with Susan or Steve, please feel free to do so. Thanks again.